This is Scott Slaba, and I'm going to talk about a little about economics and Christianity, this talk is. Linda and I just took a little walk, and I was thinking about this. It's kind of anticlimactic, this whole presentation. It's very different than it isn't very different, but in a sense, it's like the analogy that I have is when school's out, and school gets out on Friday, and class is dismissed for the summer, and you call him back on Monday to take one more math exam. I feel kind of in that role a bit, that the wrap-up that we had today for this conference, which I missed, regretfully, was at 1:30. So what I'd like to do is to kind of keep in the continuum of that discussion a little bit as part of the wrap-up, rather than make the kind of presentation that I was going to do, which Jerry, I think, is the only person so far who has gotten a glimpse of it. My original purpose, or my original intent for this conference, was to draw a little awareness to the issue of Christianity and its relationship to economics. Because in thinking about this issue for some time, it's become apparent to me that we as Christians, we as religious people, tend to overlook a real glaring fact that those of us in the business world, I think, or those of us who are working in the economic realm, can't overlook, which is that Christianity and economics have virtually nothing to do with one another. And that sounds a bit like a truism, except for the fact that it has a profound effect on how we relate to problem solving, how we relate to this issue of business ethics or ethical business. There is a historical reason for that. And we, as we go about trying to live Christian lives, trying to exercise a faith and so forth, we tend to forget that the economic community doesn't really care at all. Not one iota about our theology, about our scripture, about who we are, what we have to say, at all. Unless it means good business. Unless it means more money in their pockets. Okay. Which is not to say that there are not many good, honest, ethical business people trying to live good, honest, ethical lives. But that's another matter, I believe. And I think that what has happened in the area of ethical behavior or religious behavior is that it has moved into the realm of the personal. So that it's no coincidence that we end up talking a lot about things that are very accessible to us. Things like recycling, which is all good. Things like eating better, eating organic foods, eating or behaving in ways that are ethically sound, riding our bicycles, things that are environmentally wise, but that which really go on in a separate sphere from the whole economic machine, which grinds on. There is, again, in my presentation, in my paper that I wrote for this, I did a lot of thinking about, and I went back and did a lot of digging into some old books and really looked at where this relationship or where this split came about, and came to the conclusion or realized once again that roughly since the Reformation, the area of economics, and we're talking about the 1550s to onward, the area of economics has increasingly split off from the religious realm. Before the Reformation, up to that period of time, there had always been an economic community which had a powerful effect on the affairs. It was a financial community, but the church had a powerful say in what went on. The church was a very influential organ. And with the Reformation and the whole implication, the logical implications of the Reformation, there came to be a growing split between that, the economic, the financial community, and the religious community, which saw the religious community increasingly shrink into ever more and more personal spheres, whereas the economic community in itself began to burgeon and grow and have a life of its own. Yeah?
I'm not sure quite what you mean by economics and religion being closer together. Does that mean that economics before the Reformation were defined by religious ethics more, or does it mean the church had a bigger place at the trough, you know, for
the church was expected to comment and to participate in economic decision making, or at least the implication was that the church, that there were moral restraints implied in the way people went about in trading with one another. Which isn't to say that the big financial merchants, the at the time, roughly from the 1200s through the 1600s, it isn't to say that they didn't go about their business as they wanted. But the church was actively involved in trying to set restraints. The idea of interest, for example, was a heavy theological topic. Is it okay or is it not okay to charge interest? The church had a very strong position on that. Now, the church was very corrupt. I mean, it had become very corrupted by the time of the Reformation. We all know that. But they still maintained a role which was to protect the little guy in affairs of commerce. There was this feeling that there was a God-given hierarchy here, and people on the bottom had to be protected, had to be watched out for in a certain way, and then in some kind of way, interest wasn't a fair. It shouldn't be. It didn't fit. And so the church and religious leaders put out a great deal of time and effort to try to control. And they had power. They had a certain amount of authority in those matters. And it was that authority which, as the economic community began to assume a life of its own, that authority increasingly shrunk. And where it shrunk to was into matters that had to do more with the individual person and how the individual person related to God rather than how they related to the economic community. Okay, that's the premise that roughly I think we need to go back to, and that's the period of time we need to take a look at in order to try to examine where we're at today. Because my assertion is that from that period of time, we have seen nothing but a growing power in that economic community, and the results of which we're seeing in the environmental problems that we're confronting today. So for us to feel as though by living scriptural lives and by living moral lives we have an effect in that community is very, very difficult to believe for me. And I guess what I'm trying to do, and which I would like to invite some discussion on today, is how is it possible for us to make our theology relevant to that economic community? Okay? In the discussions and the specific examples today, you were asking for specific examples, Scott. And we were looking for things we could do for next summer. And I didn't say much about economics because I felt like it was too difficult to raise the issue. On one hand, it's much easier to talk about recycling, and it's much easier to talk about awareness, and that is good. That is absolutely true. But what role does theology have, for example, in those decisions? Do we need another condominium complex in our community? Do we need another whatever? Does our bay, our particular body of water, need to become a dump site for the army? these kinds of issues that go on, thunder on by us all the time, by this big economic establishment, what is a theological or moral response to that? Back in the 1500s, they knew, they would have known, that there was at least some moral response to that. We don't have that feeling. Something has changed, and what has changed is that we live in a different sphere than those people who make those kinds of decisions. And all I wanted to do today was raise that question so that we might think about possible ways that we could make the people who come here or the people in our religious communities refuse that moral underpinning back to those economic decisions in a way that would be appropriate to today. Now, one of the things that came out of a conversation that Ken and Linda and I had last night was kind of echoed again today when we were talking. I think you mentioned it, Scott. Somebody was saying that get people to talk about their problems. I think it was around the issue of Ecology Anonymous or something like this. Get people to talk about their issues, okay? One of the ideas I had, and again, this is where we need to open up at least the discussion that it needs to be done. One of the ideas that came out of that for me was, well, look, what if a group of people like us sat down and we started talking about what was going on in our communities and the frustrations we've had in our particular communities? How do you feel about this? How do you feel about what's happening in your community? What's happening down the street? What's happening with your zoning laws? What's happening with the corruption in your political government? What's happening with your water, the quality of your water, your streams, the fish? Those things that the economic community is foisting on your particular community. And let people's frustrations come out, and then open up a discussion about what would be a moral response to that. Not a political one, but a moral theological one to that, if you will, a moral response. I know for my part, I find that when I'm talking to people about our community, which is Bellingham, I get an enormous amount of frustration from people. We're in the midst of one of the most booming areas in the state right now, and it's just every day you drive down your favorite spot and there's a new condo, a new gas station, three new restaurants, a new motel, just all over the place. You talk to people and they're frustrated. No one knows quite what to do. This is going on in right in our front doors. They're just dropping these stuff on there in the name of private property, in the name of free enterprise. Is there no moral response to that? Is there no appropriate moral response to that? There's got to be. That's my position. There's got to be one. And what I'm thinking of trying to figure out how to do, and I need some help on this because it's something I don't see being done, and I need some dialogue in this, is to figure out what we can do to try to institute that kind of dialogue. Now, Ken's presentation last night gave me some neat ideas. His reinterpretation of an old Bible story. What Ken did was take that story, or the person who wrote it, John Sayers?
Shea.
He took it and he contemporized it, gave it a new life, a new meaning. What if we were to take biblical scripture and reinterpret biblical scripture, certain scriptures, along those same economic lines? What could we reveal? What could we learn if we started trying to do that? It was an idea for me that I thought could be pursued and maybe presented, developed a little bit. What would it reveal if we could take some of those, the biblical responses to economics, for example, some of the dialogues and stories that went in the Bible, and give them an economic interpretation or new interpretation along contemporary lines? I don't know if it's possible.
Well, you don't even have to interpret. It's Jesus was one of his main moral points was about economics, and the Acts of the Apostles makes it as a very clear economic system laid down.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with capitalism. It's communal, if anything.
But that raises a whole other issue. and that I'd really be interested in hearing you address, because I know you have a lot of thoughts about it, which is dealing with the C word, you know, dealing in a Christian context or an activist community. There is such a war going on when you speak of capitalism. And Scott's point, as I understand it, was that we have to learn to make peace with it because we're not going to overthrow the system. You know, this is what we're having to live with. Then how then do we influence and infuse some of our own political thing, or our own thinking, our own values into a system that exists if we accept the reality that there's not a big likelihood we're going to overthrow it and establish a more communal lifestyle?
You leave me behind here. But.
Well, it does raise a point, which I think is a real issue for me, too. So one of the things I think we as Christians do, and I certainly have done it and have struggled with it all my life, is we are basically at war with the current capitalist establishment on some level. We don't accept it. We see it as morally corrupt. We see it as greedy. And basically, we don't accept it. I think if we did accept it, traditionally the model is we'd probably be working in it and promoting it. But I really think we have a struggle with it, and I think it's causing us a lot of problem in terms of a dialogue with it. I have a funny cartoon that a friend of mine who's a minister told me about, which I think is appropriate. The guy comes to the door, and the door opens, and it's three Christian evangelists standing at the door, and they say, "Hello. We'd like to come in and quote Bible scripture to you and make you feel like shit. May we come in?" And the point being is that Christianity does not have look well upon those who do not believe as we do. And I think we have to really re-examine our position on the whole capitalist establishment in that way that we can accept that establishment and accept its historical position. And I think that's going to get me in a lot of trouble making that statement, because I tend to think it's a very dangerous statement to make in a Christian community. What I mean by that is that capitalism has had a historical role in bettering the economic well-being of Western civilization, and that we need to recognize that before we can begin to develop a dialogue with it. Now tell me who believes that and who doesn't. You do or you don't, Jerry?
I do.
You do believe that?
I believe it, but at what expense?
And for whom?
And for whom? Yeah. You know, Jesus talks about mammon or wealth, mm-hmm. second only to the kingdom of heaven, mm-hmm. or the reign of God, put it in contemporary language, in the scriptures. I agree. It's pretty clear. Not always. I mean, it's not always clear. Jesus was raised pretty middle class as a carpenter. He was supported out of wealthy women's means, as it says in Luke 8. And, you know, and yet really makes some very clear points about wealth and riches and mammon.
Mm-hmm.
Under that word, mammon.
Sure.
And yet I agree that, you know, a lot of wonderful things have happened in terms of people's abilities to live in some nice ways, but then at what's the expense we're paying for the environment and morally and spiritually and everything else now? Are we going to pay the piper, is what?
I would expect you would have a strong response to that.
I don't know if I have a strong response to capitalism per se. I mean, I have a strong response that says that I don't think there is an economic system prescribed in the New Testament. I don't agree with Selby that socialism is prescribed in the Book of Acts. I think that is descriptive of what happened at that time. I think other sociological studies in the New Testament have shown that it wasn't at all set up that way throughout the New Testament church. and that there were a variety of economic, quote-unquote, systems that were operative at that time, and that there were rich and poor within the church, and that there were wealthy people supporting the church who didn't necessarily prescribe to what's described in the Book of Acts of everyone selling all that they have and giving it into a common pot. And that's the only reaction I have to that.
Well, is it possible to make peace with that, to accept it, I guess is the question that I would put out. Jerry says, or agrees that it is. I guess you tentatively, Ken, would agree.
Make peace?
That's a little bit more than I... What I agree is that capitalism has created wealth.
Created wealth.
Improve the standard of living of a lot of people. And I agree with you that there's a real issue of distribution within capitalism as well. But, it's another step to say, let's make peace with it.
Okay.
Can I ask something? Could I have a definition of capitalism so I know what we're working with here?
Sure. It's an order that bases, I guess, what I would see it as in a contemporary definition of capitalism. What capitalism was originally intended to be is probably a different animal than what it is. I see it as an economic order which bases its entire premise on the acquisition of material wealth and short-term profit-taking as the primary incentive in life, the primary motivational factor in life, okay? For our purposes, I think that will suffice. Originally, and this was the point that I was making in the paper that I presented, and I would hope that you can get a chance to read it. What capitalism was conceived of was that it was a response to the need that we all were perceived to have to want to better our own condition. And capitalism has proceeded along that premise that not that the motive to improve your condition takes precedence over any other motive. That is the primary human motive. And in an era when that was not possible for the average person, that is to say back in feudal times, it was a powerful theory. It genuinely liberated a great deal of people from economic bondage and destitution. And it has essentially gone on that premise and gone out of control on that premise ever since. The idea of the economic motive as primary, of course it has acquired all these overtones of acquisition at all cost, exploitation, and it now operates, I think, essentially on greed, out of the motive of greed, or what I would call and I think it's important for this discussion, limited self-interest. It essentially operates on that. Anything that will increase material gain in a limited short-term manner is acceptable. That's essentially its morality as far as it goes.
Isn't it just a moral issue, though? I mean, capitalism in itself, in the action that it takes, it's the moral fiber that makes up whether any system, it seems to me, is going to work or get out of control. If everybody takes what they need in a capitalist society and their attitude is one of community, then that won't happen. I wouldn't expect. If you're in a socialistic or a different system, that I believe that same problem could happen.
Okay, I'm not sure what you're saying.
Moral inquiry that we need.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, so I agree that in a way we need to make peace with the theory and not fill it out. or look at it, not yeah. throw it away.
That's a good point. What I'm saying when I say make peace with it is a little bit the same phenomena, I suppose, that a lot of us felt with our parents at some point. You recognize their flaws, you recognize the limitations of them, and then finally you love them for what they are. Essentially, we're dealing with a system that has had historical roots, has been a historical necessity in many ways, has had a place in history, and all I mean when I say making peace with it is accepting that premise, so that then we can go on to begin infusing that moral dialogue back into the decision-making process that I think capitalism lacks now. Capitalism exists in a moral vacuum at this point.
Well, there's just two qualities of capitalism I want to mention too in terms of defining it. One is that it's based on growth. There was somebody who quoted a banker who was asked to speak about a no-growth economy, and he said, "I have nothing to say." It's based on expansion, constant growth. And the other is monopoly, that there's a tendency in capitalism for more and more economic power to be concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people. It's something that Marx predicted and that we've seen, I think, most graphically over the last 10 years, where there's been these vast Pac-Man games of corporations sort of gobbling each other up and forming giant entities that are bigger than most countries in some cases.
There's a little discrepancy between what you're saying is as one of the facets of capitalism is growth, and you're saying a short-term gain. Those two are contradictory.
This is a very good point. When we go back to essentially the creation of capitalism, which essentially we can trace back to Alexander Hamilton in this country and Adam Smith in England or Scotland. What the point that he was saying was, he understood a little bit better than we do the issue of wealth. Because what Smith said was, if people are able to go about pursuing their own lives and in control of their economic lives, there will be wealth for all. Adam Smith lived in a different era, we have to remember. He lived 200 years ago, 250 years ago, in a very uncomplicated society. He couldn't foresee a lot of the problems. But the point he made was, he said, people operate out of limited self-interest, but he didn't glorify that. He didn't say that was particularly good. But he said, this is what we have to deal with. He said, if people are allowed to pursue their own economic activities, they will be happier. There will be wealth for all. That was before Darwin. The idea that economics came along later, and the idea that you had to stand on somebody else's shoulder was a later idea. The idea that the acquisition of wealth meant somebody else lost was an idea that began to emerge as capitalism began to grow and evolve as a system unto itself. And the centralization you're talking about that took place became out of hand, essentially, during the exploitation of this country. That is an idea that I think is important to our understanding as Christians, as religious people, of how we can respond to capitalism. Because, in a sense, there is no reason why we can't live happy, healthy, materially satisfied lives and all benefit, is there? And we all intuitively know that. So what's the problem? Okay, a descending voice. I thought I had the answer there.
I do want to offer a descending voice. And that is that I think there are good reasons to think that the creation, if you will, can support quite a large number of people in a very reasonable manner.
That there are good reasons that it can?
It can.
Uh-huh.
But there are limitations as to how many people, at what standard of living, the creation can support. So I would want to stop short of saying that, as I was hearing your comment, that the environment, the creation, can support any arbitrary number of people. You know, I think there are limitations, and that population growth is a factor in, and you could get to the point, as has happened in some countries, particularly in Africa and Asia, where poor people destroy their environment. You can get to the point where rich people do it and begin to shorten our lifetime, increase infant mortality, do it either way. So I'd say population is a factor that has to be considered.
I don't think I said, and if I did, thank you for correcting me, but I don't think I said that we could live unlimited.
Okay.
In an unlimited, in fact, the points that I was making in the paper was that one of the responses that I think the Christian faith can make to the capitalist mentality is one of contributing a concept of enlightened self-restraint. That is to say, if capitalism has grown to be the monstrous evil that it is today, if you will, by a concept of unlimited self, total lack of restraint, you just take what you can get and to hell with the rest, okay? Then one of the things that we, as a moral response to that, would be to teach what does restraint really mean in an ecological sense, in a global sense. Let's see a model of restraint that's healthy. That is to say, one where we restrain our impulse to buy a new car and instead we ride up bicycles, or we make the old one last longer, or we upgrade it or something. We reuse and we recycle. Those are all restraints which have moral imperatives to them and which have ecological overtones to it.
Restraints on the system, restraints on people. I think the capitalist system is a system that's essentially a free market mechanism for making decisions about what should or shouldn't be done with regard to the production of goods and services. And any restraint on the market is considered by those who believe in this system to be a problem and to be negative. It should be free. And now, within that context, everybody is free to do what he or she pleases, and that's not the problem. The problem is when anybody tries to restrain and interfere with the market mechanism, which is the only motive there is profit. And those who support the system would say that if you interfere with profit as the motive, you will destroy the system and you get all kinds of problems. So you shouldn't have any interference within the economic system with profit as the motive.
You're saying that's the way it is, Alan.
That's the way I read the theorists. All the theories about motivation are, that doesn't really matter why people do what they do. The theory is that people will buy and sell according to their own interests, and so you just have a system which takes that into account.
Okay, we have to be careful, I think, with the term profit. Because if we take the term profit and we say we're interfering with the profit, but it's not really profit. It's like, as I was pointing out in this paper, the sin of the rich man, right, in the Bible? The man who lays away the fortunes and the wealth. What is that person really doing? What is he doing? He's making a profit on the future by stealing from the future. The person who calls profit, who refers to the term profit, and it's really a theft from the future, is not really talking about profit. He's talking about theft, but he's passing it off as profit.
Well, he still makes the dollars and cents.
He still makes the dollars and cents, but the point of it is that if we are living in a finite globe, and we are living with finite resources, then we really better get our language straight.
The problem is with the system is it doesn't take into account certain factors like the ecosphere. The system of profit and loss does not, there's no way to factor in that. The theory being, of course, when oil gets very short, and the price will go up, and then the whole system will function to limit us in purchasing it, because the price will go up. You know, the fact is that the system doesn't factor in all the costs. There's no way to factor in the future. No way to factor in the desires of people who are going to live 1,000 years from now.
It's even worse than that. So there's quite a lot that has been done over the last 10 years on the economics of resource depletion. And a key factor in all of this, and one that ties into something you were saying earlier, is the discount rate, it's called. The essence of corporate thinking is captured and right there for us to see in the drugstore in the calculators. There are those calculators. The MDA was the first one that really had this feature. There are four buttons across the top of those calculators. One is for the principal, one is for the interest rate, one is present value, and one is future value. And when you're talking about interest and usury, that is a really central factor in determining whether a corporation or whether a person has a long-term perspective on things. Because when you start looking at the future value of something and putting it in terms of present value and comparing the present value of two things that you might invest in, which is basically the way in which decisions get made that have some bearing on you know, stealing from the future, if you will. The way in which that gets done is through that discount rate and the expectation as to what interest rates are going to be in the future. And the higher the interest rate, the more rapidly you lose any interest in future value. And the kind of it decays exponentially, the value that you put on things in the future. And the higher the interest rate, the faster it decays. And you can take the interest rate and divide by 70, or actually 0.7, and get a measure in years as to how far into the future the current interest rate will allow economic decision makers to look. And I think that somehow we need to come back to understanding what was the theological issue when usury was such a major factor, because high interest rates, high discount rates, banking generally, but and creating money through interest rates, that's all a critical part of the short-sightedness of the market system. And I haven't any understanding at all of what the theological arguments were against usury. But one of the things that's on my list to do is to someday understand that, because I think it's through that we might begin to get some control over the capital system.
I do too, and I don't understand it either. And perhaps we can get some help from you guys, if you do, Scott or Dan, because I know what the argument was. And I know that it was a powerful argument. Basically, the argument generally breaks down that it wasn't work. There was a sense that we were coming from an area where people worked with their hands, they worked with their backs, they worked. The idea that people would make money off of an abstraction at some point in our history did not make sense. And that's as far as I can trace it. I mean, at this point, and I also want to pursue this further too, because I think that's what we're, if we can see this see this movement and how incredibly out of hand it has gotten, and we go back to those roots and we look at them a little bit better, we can begin to put it in its proper context and proper perspective. This issue that Al raises, though, short term, I want to get back to that again, because that's or the profit, because it's a critical one. Recently, I saw that the Japanese response. Of course, right now, it's what's going on with the Japanese is very interesting. The Japanese have a huge trade surplus. Of course, at the same time, we have a very similar trade deficit. Our government is putting an enormous amount of pressure on the Japanese right now to get that out of line, I mean, get that back into line so they're not, that surplus goes away. Japanese are trying to figure out, they're a little defensive right now. They don't quite know how to respond. There are a lot of debates going on. So at one point they got fairly testy and they threw back the argument right into our laps. And they said, well, why don't you clean up your own house first? And then you might find yourself having a surplus yourself. And one of the things they said was that get your trade deficit, quit spending more than you're making, quit being obsessively preoccupied with short-term profits, clean up your poor educational system. Those were three other things. There was a couple other things that they said too. But the fact that they would mention to us that part of what they were doing had to do with our, or part of our problem had to do with our own obsession with short-term profits, I thought was very interesting for a culture that's 2,000 years old to be telling us. And I think they are getting closer to what we as Christians and we as people who are concerned with genuine wealth creation need to get to, which is how do we clean up that word profit? Because I do feel that if we live in a restrained, an enlightened restrained society, if we know what restraint means in a global sense, there is enough for all of us. And in that sense, I think the idea that that wealth will spring from people being content, well-fed, well-cared for, in an ecological sense, makes a lot of sense. And in that sense, if that's what, quote, the economic community or, quote, capitalism were about, I could live with it. That's not what it's about.
But what capitalism is really about is the concentration of wealth. And so we have a Donald Trump who has $4 billion that he has not earned. And we have people in El Salvador who are $90 a year and who have half of their children starve. And that's a trend that's gotten worse and worse. And it's independent of the population growth and everything else. Capitalism and Reaganism certainly fit in with that. It takes a lot away from people on the lower end of the scale and gives it to rich people. So, mm-hmm. and that's an inherent tendency in capitalism. So how do we do that?
$40 billion worth of our trade deficit by requiring the cars to get 50 miles an hour. It would reduce our trade deficit by $40 billion.
But it gets in the way of profit. Yeah. No, make more money.
I don't know
turning
if it gets
cars.
In the way
they
of
make
profit.
More
it
money
doesn't.
Cars.
But it gets in
it,
the way of the theory of the economic system, namely that the government does not really intervene. It's a free market system. And they resent any intervention by any outside force.
Okay, fantasy time. Okay, just a second. If we just take a fantasy, we take this issue, 40 miles to gallon or 60 miles. It's not unheard of. Technology is there to produce cars that get 60. What if we as Christians, we as a theological community, as a Christian community, were to make it our issue that we were going to put focus, just fantasy now, we're going to focus all our efforts for the next year on getting across the notion to Detroit, whatever means it took, through publicity, through political pressure, through putting our resources into education, in the schools, and whatever we came up with in our individual lives, that the idea that we're living in a country now that has our own resources, they're estimating 20 to 25 years worth of petroleum. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's about what I've heard recently, that readjusting the figures, it's less than they thought. Yeah, well, but in our country, they've readjusted the figures down. Okay, and that we're living in we have finite resources. If we were to convince them that it would make sense to convert from a petroleum-based economy, just took that one issue and talked about, really got into the issue of making a transition to cars that were going to get 60 miles to a gallon, really talked strategy to them. When are we going to get solar powered, alternative powered cars, alcohol-based cars? What would be a transition? If we were just to do that as a community, and really talked about the idiocy of producing cars that are wasteful, that are deliberately glutting the limited amount of petroleum we have, I can't believe that that wouldn't have an effect. I think that the issue you raised, Selby, is restating the problem. I think part of the problem is that we as a community haven't made that kind of response.
Lots of people have been working on that.
But I know, individually, we've made that response as a community. We've done that response, I think, in terms of the injustices in El Salvador, where they're clearly obvious. We have responded as a community in areas where the atrocities are so apparent. The response of the Christian community to the atrocities, recent atrocities in El Salvador, I think, is a case in point where the emotional issues are strong, where we have a strong sense of our connectedness.
I don't think we have done anything. I'm not aware that the bishops of churches have written a letter to General Motors as strong as was written to El Salvador.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, in connection with the assassination of those eight Jesuits. You know, in that sense, I'd say so. We haven't made that.
No, that's true. The church has it.
Yeah.
The Catholic Bishops' Conference.
The Catholic Bishops' Conference 3 or 4 years ago.
On economics.
Right. That was direction. A beginning. That was a beginning, and I was taken by that. That was so marvelous. And it was very interesting to see the response that it got. Cynicism.
Oh, yeah.
It was laughed at in the straight establishment.
No, it wasn't laughed at. It was feared.
Feared, I mean, yeah.
There was a big backlash. And,
cynicism is probably a better word for it.
The Irving Crystals and the others really got real busy and cranked up to produce their alternative.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I know. But what I mean is, it was a very nervous kind of thing as it got more publicity and more press. But it was an attempt to really squash it. But it shows the power that it had.
Exactly.
But let me say that a factor that was really important in that, and also the bishop's pastor letters on peace, is that they were quality work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was well researched, well thought out, well tested, vetted with a lot of people. When you compare the quality of that with the stuff that comes out of the National Council of Churches, and it just isn't there. You compare that with the Lutheran social statements. You know, it's pablum.
Tripe.
Yeah. Those two things were well done. There was quality in that work. And there's where I think the church has really stumbled, is that they don't have capacity. You know, you say there was a separation that started developing way back then. I think that a part, anyway, of the reason that there is a separation of the church and theological issues from the economic side is that there's nobody in the theological side that understands the economic system. Nobody prepared to do quality analysis that really knows how to find the facts and make the arguments in a way that are as compelling as they were in the Catholic Bishop's letter. And institutionally, I think if we're ever going to do this, we've got to find a way to not put our foot into our mouth up to the knee every time the church opens its mouth.
But we need to ask ourselves why we haven't made those kinds of quality responses.
Because we're addicted.
We are.
I would say I'd go a little easier on ourselves to the extent that I would say because we haven't seen it as our issue.
I think we're addicted.
No, we've seen it as an issue. We've never had a structure. We've got so many denominations and so many people in social action around. And each one has a little bit of a budget, and there's no budget to support staff, first thing. Second, we do not have a lot of clergy who don't have anything else to do, so they get PhDs. The clergy get PhDs. They're all over the universities getting PhDs in subject matters other than theology. They are trained theologically, and they're getting PhDs in economics and politics and law. They're just all over the lot. So secondly, they have personnel within the clergy who are well trained in the disciplines. And thirdly, they have a history of writing encyclicals. on the part of the church on everything under the sun. And we have a history of writing little papers.
Well, I think that's that. That sounds. I can't comment on that, but
that's just the history.
Yeah.
I mean, I've worked on this thing for 50 years, and you can't get any systematic. National Council's tried a little, but their resources are so limited; they're being cut. Now, why that is another matter. But it's clear that the Heritage Foundations and all kinds of foundations supported by the right-wing churches are now getting money from the right-wing churches. They're now training and supporting the right-wing church social policy.
Yeah.
And we have that. That's the history.
I guess what I would say is come back to my original point, which was this, is that the purpose of my presentation is to draw attention and say that we do need to become aware of it, but we need to know when to quit restating the problem and say, okay, we need to put out the quality kind of quality work we're talking about there. For whatever reason we haven't, we need to begin changing that. And make that kind of a quality statement on that level of economics where it hasn't happened in a strong, concise, clear, sophisticated way that represents the kind of moral truths we want to see lived out in the economic realm. For whatever reason we haven't done it, I think we need to begin doing that. I guess that would be my argument. And the historical reasons are what they are. You know?
I think we have a reason to do it as well. I think there would be some who would offer a qualification to your statement on the separation of economics and religion since the Protestant Reformation, and that, for example, Max Weber said that Protestantism was the driving force behind capitalism.
That's a whole other subject.
Unconscious.
It allowed it to happen.
That's right.
It became its prime rationale.
But I think one step that the church, we have definitely talked and glorified within the church the self-made person. And I think that one step that we need to take in our encyclicals, if that's what it's going to do, is to say Donald Trump isn't the glory of God. Isn't the glory of what we as church people are trying to seek for. And I think that's important because of our unconscious support of the type of system that's made him what he is.
Mm-hmm.
I would debate with the historical aspect. I think that Protestantism has been unconscious support of the capitalist.
Just one response to that, Dan, is I think that it has been the Protestant, what the Protestant faith has set free, which is the human being from the institution, the idea of works as salvation, has been used by financial capitalistic interests. And I think that's the point that Weber was making in his work, is that's what capitalism has been. Protestantism has been, like I say, the prime rationale of capitalism, but that we really need to be careful with that, because that's not what people like Luther were saying, for example, or even Calvin, for that matter. They weren't promoting unlimited, the kind of capitalism we've seen. Anyway, I think we have to quit.
I think it's been very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.